Efficiency and capability can be multiplied without requiring a bigger investment. For example, when Apple Inc. needed to achieve rapid growth with flat resources in one division, they didn't expand their sales force. Instead, they gathered the key players across the various job functions, took a week to study the problem, and collaboratively developed a solution. They changed the sales model to utilize competency centers and better leverage their best salespeople and deep industry experts in the sales cycle. They achieved year-over-year growth in the double digits with virtually flat resources. Salesforce, a $7 billion software firm that has pioneered software as a service, has been making the shift from the logic of addition to the logic of multiplication. They enjoyed a decade of outstanding growth using the old idea of throwing resources at a problem. They addressed new customers and new demands by hiring the best technical and business talent available and deploying them on the challenges. However, a strained market environment created a new imperative for the company's leadership: get more productivity from their currently available resources. They could no longer operate on outdated notions of resource utilization. They started developing leaders who could multiply the intelligence and capability of the people around them and increase the brain power of the organization to meet their growth demands. Resource leverage is a far richer concept than merely accomplishing more with less. Multipliers don't get more with less. They get more by using more. More of people's intelligence and capability, enthusiasm, and trust. As one CEO put it, 80 people can either operate with the productivity of 50, or they can operate as though they were 500. And because these multipliers achieve better resource efficiency, they enjoy a strengthened competitive position against companies entrenched in the logic of addition. We want to strike at the root of this outdated addition logic. Let's turn to the question of how multipliers access intelligence and get so much from people. The answer is in the mindset and the five disciplines of the multiplier. The mind of the multiplier. As we studied diminishers and multipliers, we consistently found that they hold radically different assumptions about the intelligence of the people they work with. These assumptions appear to explain much of the difference in how diminishers and multipliers operate. The mind of the diminisher. The diminisher's view of intelligence is based on elitism and scarcity. Diminishers appear to believe that really intelligent people are a rare breed, and that they are of that rare breed. From this assumption, they conclude that they are so special, other people will never figure things out without them. I recall a leader I worked with whom I can only describe as an intellectual supremacist. This senior executive ran a technology organization employing more than 4,000 highly educated knowledge workers, most of them graduates of top universities from around the world. I joined one of his management meetings in which 20 members of his senior management team were troubleshooting an important go-to-market problem for one of their products. As we walked out of the meeting, we were reflecting on the conversation and the decisions made. He stopped, turned to me, and calmly said, "In meetings, I typically only listen to a couple of people. No one else really has anything to offer." I think he saw the alarm on my face because after his words came out, he added the awkward postscript, "Well, of course, you're one of those people." I doubted it. Out of the top 20 managers representing a division of 4,000 people, he believed only a couple had anything to offer. As we walked down the hallway, we passed by rows and rows of cubicles and offices occupied by his staff. Seen through new eyes, this expanse now suddenly looked like a massive brain power wasteland. I wanted to make a public announcement and tell them that they could all go home since their senior executive didn't think they had much to offer. In addition to seeing intelligence as a scarce commodity, Our research showed that diminishers regard intelligence as something basic about a person that can't change much. They believe that it's static, not able to change over time or circumstance. This attitude is consistent with what Dr. Carol Dweck, noted psychologist and author, calls a fixed mindset, a belief that one's intelligence and qualities are carved in stone. Diminisher's two-step logic appears to be that people who don't get it now never will. Therefore, I need to keep doing the thinking for everyone. In the diminisher world, there is no vacation for smart people. You can probably predict how the executive described previously actually operated on a day-to-day basis. You might ask yourself how you would operate if deep down you held these beliefs. You would probably tell people what to do, make all the important decisions, and jump in and take over when someone appeared to be failing. And in the end, you would almost always be right, because your assumptions would cause you to manage in a way that produced subordination and dependency. The mind of the multiplier. Multipliers hold very different assumptions. If diminishers see the world of intelligence in black and white, multipliers see it in technicolor. Multipliers have a rich view of the intelligence of the people around them. They don't see a world where just a few people deserve to do the thinking. In addition, multipliers see intelligence as continually developing. This observation is consistent with what Dweck calls a growth mindset, a belief that basic qualities like intelligence and ability can be cultivated through effort. They assume that people are smart and will figure it out. To their eyes, their organization is full of talented people who are capable of contributing at much higher levels. They think like one manager we interviewed who takes stock of her team members by asking herself, in what way is this person smart? In answering this question, she finds colorful capabilities often hidden just below the surface. Instead of writing people off as not worth her time, she's able to ask, what could be done to develop and grow these capabilities? She then finds an assignment that both stretches the individual and furthers the interests of the organization. Multipliers look at the complex opportunities and challenges swirling around them and think, there are smart people everywhere who will figure this out and get even smarter in the process. And they see that their job is to bring the right people together in an environment that liberates everyone's best thinking, and then to get out of their way and let them do it. How would you operate if you held these assumptions? In the most trying times, you would trust your people. You would extend hard challenges to them and allow them space to fulfill their responsibilities. You would access their intelligence in a way that would actually make them smarter. The following information summarizes how these very different sets of assumptions have a powerful effect on the way diminishers and multipliers lead others. How would you manage talent? As a diminisher, you would use talent. As a multiplier, you would develop talent. How would you approach mistakes? As a diminisher, you would blame people. As a multiplier, explore and learn. How would you set direction? Diminishers tell people what to do. Multipliers challenge them. How would you make decisions? Diminishers decide. Multipliers consult with people. How would you get things done? As a diminisher, you would control. As a multiplier, you would support. These core assumptions are essential to unearth and understand because, quite simply, behavior follows assumptions. If someone wants to lead like a multiplier, he or she can't simply mimic the practices of the multiplier. An aspiring multiplier must start by thinking like a multiplier. In 20 years of watching and coaching executives, I have observed how leaders' assumptions affect their management. When someone begins by examining and potentially upgrading their core assumptions, they will more easily adopt the five disciplines of the multiplier with authenticity and impact. The five disciplines of the multiplier. So what are the practices that distinguish the multiplier? In analyzing data on more than 150 leaders, we found a number of areas in which multipliers and diminishers do the same things. Both groups are customer-driven. Both show strong business acumen and market insight. Both surround themselves with smart people and consider themselves thought leaders. However, as we searched the data for the active ingredients unique to multipliers, we found five disciplines in which multipliers differentiate themselves from diminishers. Number one, attracting and optimizing talent. Multipliers are talent magnets. They attract and deploy talent to its fullest, regardless of who owns the resource. And people flock to work with them because they know they will grow and be successful. In contrast, diminishers operate as empire builders, insisting that they must own and control all resources to be more productive. They tend to divide resources into those they own and those they don't, and then allow these artificial separations to hamstring effective use of all resources and restrict growth. People may initially be attracted to work with a diminisher, but it's often the place where people's careers die. The diminisher is an empire builder who acquires resources and then wastes them. The multiplier is a talent magnet who utilizes and increases everyone's genius. Number two, creating intensity that requires best thinking. Multipliers establish a unique and highly motivating work environment where everyone has permission to think and the space to do their best work. Multipliers operate as liberators, which produces a climate that is both comfortable and intense. They're able to remove fear and create the safety that invites people to do their best thinking. At the same time, they are creating an intense environment that demands people's best efforts. In contrast, diminishers operate as tyrants, introducing judgment and a fear of judgment, which have a chilling effect on people's thinking and work. Diminishers try to demand everyone's best thinking, yet they don't get it. The diminisher is a tyrant who creates a stressful environment. The multiplier is a liberator who creates a safe environment that fosters bold thinking. Number three, extending challenges. Multipliers act as challengers, continually challenging themselves and others to push beyond what they know. How do they do this? They seed opportunities, lay down challenges that stretch the organization, and in doing so, generate belief that it can be done and enthusiasm about the process. In contrast, diminishers operate as know-it-alls, personally giving directives to showcase their knowledge. While diminishers set a direction, multipliers ensure that a direction gets set. The diminisher is a know-it-all who gives directives. The multiplier is a challenger who defines opportunities. Number four, debating decisions. Multipliers operate as debate makers, driving sound decisions through rigorous debate. The decision-making process they foster contains all the information the organization needs to be ready to execute those decisions. Multipliers engage people in debating the issues up front, which leads to decisions that people understand and can execute efficiently. In contrast, diminishers operate as decision makers who seem to make decisions efficiently within a small inner circle, but they leave the broader organization in the dark to debate the soundness of the leader's decisions and with none of the satisfaction of helping to fine-tune and execute them. Diminishers are decision makers who try to sell their decisions to others. Multipliers are debate makers who generate real buy-in. Number five, instilling ownership and accountability. Multipliers deliver and sustain superior results by inculcating high expectations across the organization. They serve as investors who provide the necessary resources for success. In addition, they hold people accountable for their commitments. Over time, multipliers' high expectations turn into an unrelenting presence, driving people to hold themselves and each other accountable, often to higher standards and without the direct intervention of the multiplier. In contrast, diminishers serve as micromanagers who drive results by holding on to ownership, jumping into the details, and directly managing for results. The diminisher is a micromanager who jumps in and out. The multiplier is an investor who gives others ownership and full accountability. The following summarizes the five vital disciplines that we just covered that differentiate diminishers and multipliers. The five disciplines of the multipliers. When it comes to what they see, the diminisher assumes that people won't figure it out without me. When it comes to what they do, number one, the diminisher is an empire builder who hoards resources and underutilizes talent. Number two, the diminisher is a tyrant who creates a tense environment that suppresses people's thinking and capability. Number three, the diminisher is a know-it-all who gives directives that showcase how much they know. Number four, the diminisher is a decision maker who makes centralized, abrupt decisions that confuse the organization. Number five, the diminisher is a micromanager who drives results through their personal involvement. And what do they get? The diminisher's result is less than 50%. Let's look at the multiplier. When it comes to what the multiplier sees, the multiplier assumes people are smart and will figure it out. When it comes to what they do, for the multiplier, number one, the multiplier is a talent magnet who attracts talented people and uses them at their highest point of contribution. Number two, the multiplier is a liberator who creates an intense environment that requires people's best thinking and work. Number three, the multiplier is a challenger who defines an opportunity that causes people to stretch. Number four, the multiplier is a debate maker who drives sound decisions through rigorous debate. Number five, the multiplier is an investor who gives other people ownership for results and invests in their success. And what does the multiplier get? The multiplier gets twice the capability of the diminisher. Surprising findings. As we studied multipliers across the world, we found a remarkable amount of consistency and several patterns that confirmed our early observations. Here are four surprising and intriguing findings that we want to share. Number one, they have a hard edge. One of the most critical insights from our study of multipliers is how hard-edged these managers are. They expect great things from their people and drive them to achieve extraordinary results. They are beyond results-driven. They are tough and exacting. Indeed, multipliers make people feel smart and capable, but they don't do it by being feel-good managers. They look into people and find capability. And they want to access all of it and utilize people at their fullest. They see a lot, so they expect a lot. During our research interviews, people oozed appreciation for the multipliers they had worked with. But the gratitude was rooted in the deep satisfaction found in working with them, not in the pleasantries of a relationship. One person described working with Deb Lang, a senior vice president of taxation at a large firm. She said working with her was like an intense workout. It was exhausting, but totally exhilarating. Another said of his manager, "He got things from me I didn't know I had to give. I would do almost anything to not disappoint him." An executive who reported to Derek Williams, executive vice president of Oracle's Asia Pacific region, put it this way. When you left his office, you felt so much taller. The multiplier approach to management isn't just an enlightened view of leadership. It is an approach that delivers high performance because it gets vastly more out of people and returns to them a richly satisfying experience. As one early reader of this book noted, these leaders aren't about cupcakes and kisses. Number two, they don't play small. People often assume that multiplier leaders have to step to the side in order to shine a spotlight on others, or that they play small so that others can play big. However, I found that these leaders not only utilize all of the intelligence and talent of the people around them, they use all of their own as well. One of my favorite multiplier leaders is Magic Johnson. Even back in high school, when he was just Irvin Johnson Jr., he was a phenomenally talented basketball player. His high school coach told him, "Irvin, every time you get the ball, I want you to take the shot." And so he did, and he scored a lot of points as they won every game. They would score 54 points, and Irvin would have made 52 of them. The coach loved it, and the players loved it, because what boy doesn't want to be on an undefeated team? But then, after one particular game, as the players were leaving the gym and heading out to their cars, Irvin noticed the faces of the parents, who had come to watch their sons play basketball, but instead ended up watching this superstar. He said, "I made a decision at this very young age that I would use my God-given talent to help everyone on the team be a better player." And this decision eventually earned him the nickname Magic for his ability to raise the level of excellence of every team he ever played on and of every person on those teams. It's not that these multipliers shrink so that others can be big. It's that they play in a way that invites others to play big too. Number three, they have a great sense of humor. On a whim, we added "great sense of humor" to our leadership survey. Our suspicion proved right. Not only is this trait prominent among multipliers, it is one of the traits that is most negatively correlated with the mindset held by diminishers. Multipliers aren't necessarily comedians, but they don't take themselves or situations too seriously. Perhaps because they don't need to defend their own intelligence, multipliers can laugh at themselves and see comedy in error and in life's foibles, and their sense of humor has a liberating effect on others. Multiple workplace studies conclude that humor strengthens relationships, reduces stress, and increases empathy. Those who work in a fun environment have greater productivity, interpersonal effectiveness, and call in sick less often. Leaders who operate with a sense of humor create an environment where people can contribute at their fullest. Think of George Clooney when you think of the humor of the multiplier. It's a self-deprecating wit and an ability to put others at ease, allowing people to be themselves. As one journalist wrote of Clooney, "After 15 minutes, he made me feel comfortable in my own house." A Clooney co-star said, "He has a way of daring you, which can be irresistible." Multipliers use humor to create comfort and to spark the natural energy and intelligence of others. Number four, the accidental diminisher. Perhaps one of our biggest surprises was realizing how few diminishers understood the restrictive impact they were having on others. Most of them had grown up praised for their personal intelligence and had moved up the management ranks on account of personal and often intellectual merit. When they became the boss, they assumed it was their job to be the smartest and to manage a set of subordinates. Others had once had the mind and even the heart of the multiplier, but they had been working among diminishers for so long that they inherited many of their practices and absorbed their worldview. As one executive put it, When I read your findings, I realized that I have been living in diminisher land so long that I have gone native. Many people have worked for diminishers, and although they may have escaped unscathed, they carry some of the residual effects in their own leadership. The good news for the accidental diminisher is that there is a viable path to becoming a multiplier. Chapter 7, The Accidental Diminisher, is for well-meaning, decent managers who are underutilizing their people despite having the very best intentions. The promise of this book. As we studied multipliers and diminishers, we heard case after case of smart individuals being underutilized by their leaders. We heard their frustration as they told us how little some leaders got from them, despite how hard they were working and how they tried to give more. We learned that it is indeed possible to be both overworked and underutilized. Latent talent exists everywhere. Organizations are replete with under-challenged resources. Multipliers are out there. They know how to find this dormant intelligence, challenge it, and put it to use at its fullest. Great multipliers exist in business, in education, in nonprofits, and in government. Consider just a few whom you'll hear more about later. K.R. Sridhar, successful green tech entrepreneur and CEO, who recruits A-plus talent and then gives them an environment with a lot of pressure but very little stress, and allows them to experiment and take risks until the right technology and solutions emerge. Alyssa Gallagher, an assistant superintendent who led a charge to revolutionize learning across her school district by giving ownership to the teachers and letting them be the revolutionaries. Lutz Ziab, general manager of Microsoft Learning, whose team says of him, he creates an environment where good things happen. He recruits great people, allows them to make mistakes, and ferociously debates the important decisions. He demands our best, but then shares the success with the whole team. Sue Siegel, former biotech president turned venture capitalist whose business partner described a Sue effect. Everything around her gets better and companies grow under her guidance. He said, I often wonder what people are like when they aren't around Sue. Larry Gelwex, head coach of Highland Rugby, whose high school varsity team's record is 392 wins and just 9 losses in 34 years. He attributes this extraordinary record to a deliberate leadership philosophy that engages the intelligence of his players on and off the field. Leaders like these provide an aspiration point for those who would be multipliers. The promise is simple. You can be a multiplier. You can create genius around you and receive a higher contribution from your people. You can choose to think like a multiplier and operate like one. This book will show you how, and it will show you why it matters. This is a book for every manager trying to navigate the resource strain of tough economic times. It is a message for leaders who must accomplish more by getting more out of their people. As companies shed excess resources, the need for leaders who can multiply the intelligence and capability around them is more vital than ever. This book is also for the raging multiplier who seeks to better understand what he or she does naturally, as well as for the aspiring multiplier who wishes to get the full capability and intelligence from his or her people. And it is most certainly for the diminishers, so they can better understand the negative effects of leadership centered on their own intelligence. It is for every manager seeking the promise of the multiplier to increase intelligence everywhere and with everyone. As you listen, you will hear a few central messages. Number one, diminishers underutilize people and leave capability on the table. Number two, multipliers increase intelligence in people and in organizations. people actually get smarter and more capable around them. Number 3, multipliers leverage their resources. Corporations can get 2 times more from their resources by turning their most intelligent resources into intelligent multipliers. Before turning our attention to the practices of the multiplier, let's clarify what this book is not. It is not a prescription for a nice guy, feel-good model of leadership. Rather, this book discusses a hard-edged approach to management that allows people to contribute more of their abilities. And although there will be much discussion of multipliers and diminishers, this book isn't about what they achieve themselves. It is about the impact that these leaders have on others. It is about the impact and the promise of the multiplier. And lastly, the ideas offered here are not intended to be terms for labeling your diminishing boss and your colleagues. Rather, I offer a framework for helping you to develop the practices of a multiplier. This book has been designed as an end-to-end learning experience, offering an opportunity to both understand and implement the multiplier ideas. This introduction has provided a first glance into the multiplier effect and an overview of what multipliers do. Succeeding chapters will clarify the differences between multipliers and diminishers and will present the 5 disciplines of the multiplier and how you can minimize your accidental diminisher tendencies. You'll also gain a set of strategies for dealing with the inevitable diminishers around you. You will hear stories of real multipliers and diminishers, but be aware that we've changed the diminishers' names and the names of their companies for rather obvious reasons. The book concludes with a roadmap for becoming a multiplier leader and for building a multiplier culture across an entire enterprise. My challenge to you. Although the multiplier diminisher framework might appear binary, I want to emphasize that there's a continuum between multipliers and diminishers, with just a small number of people at either polar extreme. Our research showed that most of us fall along this spectrum and have the ability to move toward the side of the multiplier. With the right intent, the multiplier approach to leadership can be developed. The good news is that 1, multipliers are out there. 2, we have studied them to uncover their secrets. And 3, you can learn to become one. And not only can you become a multiplier yourself, you can find and create other multipliers that will make you a multiplier of multipliers. In this spirit, I challenge you to read this book on several levels. At the most fundamental level, it might illuminate what you undoubtedly have experienced, that some leaders create genius, while others destroy it. Or you might go beyond this and reflect on the quintessential multipliers and diminishers who have been part of your career and life experience. But perhaps the best way to approach the book is to look beyond the idea that you or your colleagues are multipliers and instead spot yourself at times in the guise of diminisher. The greatest power of these ideas might be in realizing that you have the mind of a multiplier but have been living in a diminisher world and have lost your way. Perhaps you are an accidental diminisher. As I have journeyed into the world of multipliers and diminishers, I have often seen glimpses of myself, either in the present or from years past, and have found ways to better exemplify the multiplier in my own work, teaching and coaching leaders around the world. I've come to see that most of us have a diminisher side, or at least a few vulnerabilities, mostly born of the best of intentions. I certainly do. While we may not entirely rid ourselves of our diminishing tendencies, we can certainly work to string together as many multiplier moments as possible. Multipliers is a guide to those of you who wish to follow the path of the multiplier. And like British Prime Minister Benjamin Disraeli, Leave those you meet thinking they, rather than you, are the smartest person in the world. It is a book for executives who want to see their organization with more multipliers and watch everyone and everything get better. Let me now introduce you to the fascinating and diverse set of leaders we call multipliers. They come from all walks of life, from corporate boardrooms and our school's classrooms, from the executive suite to the fields of Africa. And the leaders we've selected represent diverse ideologies. I encourage you to learn from everyone, even those whose political views you do not share. None of these leaders is perfect, but as we look into some of their finest multiplier moments, we can discover new possibilities. I hope you will find their stories, their practices, and their impact as inspiring as we did when we entered their worlds. Chapter 1 Summary: Multipliers versus Diminishers. Multipliers. These leaders are genius makers who bring out the intelligence in others. They build collective, viral intelligence in organizations. Diminishers. These leaders are absorbed in their own intelligence, stifle others, and deplete the organization of crucial intelligence and capability. The five disciplines of the multipliers. Number 1, the talent magnet. Attracts and optimizes talent. Number 2, the liberator. Requires people's best thinking. Number 3, the challenger. Extends challenges. Number 4, the debate maker. Debates decisions. Number 5, the investor. Instills accountability. The accidental diminisher. While true diminishers are easier to spot, much of the diminishing that transpires in the workplace is a result of well-intended leaders whose honest attempts to lead or be helpful shut down ideas and cause others to hold back. The results. By extracting people's full capability, multipliers get twice the capability from people as do diminishers. Chapter 2, The Talent Magnet. I not only use all the brains that I have, but all that I can borrow. Woodrow Wilson. When you walk up to the porch of her house in Menlo Park, California, you can sense that Meg Whitman, then CEO of eBay, has spent time on the East Coast. With its salt box shape and white wood, the house looks like it should be in New England. Perhaps it reminds Meg of her time in Cambridge, Massachusetts, while at business school. It was September 2007, early in the race for the 2008 presidential nomination. There were many interesting candidates vying for the ticket for both parties. That day was a chance for us locals to get a peek at one of the candidates, and for me, it was a chance to extend our research and gain insight into two interesting leaders. As the guests gathered on her backyard lawn, Meg Whitman took the microphone and began to introduce Mitt Romney as a candidate for President of the United States. Her introduction was simple. I was a young consultant at Bain Company and had the good fortune to work for Mitt Romney early in my career. After we were hired, all the new consultants scrambled to get on Mitt's project teams. Why? The word spread that he was the best boss to work for because he knew how to lead a team and he grew his people. Everyone grew around Mitt. You can imagine Meg, a newly minted Harvard MBA, ready to make her mark on the business world. Like many MBAs, she chose to begin her career at Bain & Company, an elite business consulting firm. She knew landing in the right place inside would determine how quickly she'd learn and advance her career and her value in the marketplace. She heard from one of the more senior consultants, "If you're smart, you'll find a spot on Mitt Romney's team." She didn't quite know why Mitt was such a great boss, but being savvy, she maneuvered her way onto his team. She learned why when she started working with him. On Mitt's team, people were engaged. He took the time to get to know each person and to understand the capabilities they brought to the team. This went well beyond reviewing their resumes. MIT would determine what people were naturally good at and find a way to use those talents with the client engagement. In assigning people to roles, MIT asked questions like, "What is the next challenge for you? What would be a stretch assignment?" It wasn't unusual for someone on MIT's team to be loaned to another group if their skills could help rescue a troubled project. In one-on-one meetings, MIT not only asked about the status of project deliverables, he asked about the blockers. A favorite question was, "What is getting in the way of your being successful?" Meanwhile, many of MIT's colleagues didn't get the same guidance and found themselves working for company leaders who appeared more concerned with advancing their own careers than growing the people on their team. Team meetings typically consisted of long briefings from project leaders, followed by the usual project updates from each of the consultants who reported on progress in their functional area. People stuck to their roles on the team. When one person was struggling, he or she usually just suffered in silence and pulled a few all-nighters rather than solicit help from colleagues. The job got done, but individual efforts were not acknowledged. The only visible recognition came in the form of kudos for the project leader and an increase in the size of his or her organization. As for the destiny of the project members, they were almost certainly guaranteed a role in the next project that closely resembled what they had done on the last project. In any organization, there are talent magnets, people who attract the best talent, utilize it to its fullest, and ready it for the next stage. These are leaders who have a reputation not only for delivering results, but for creating a place where young, talented people can grow. They're accelerators to other people's careers. Mitt Romney operated as a talent magnet. He accelerated the career of Meg Whitman, who went on to be CEO of eBay and lead an 88 times increase in revenue. And Mitt has been a magnet and an accelerator in the careers of hundreds of people with similar stories, not only Meg. Perhaps you are a talent magnet. Would your people describe you as someone who recognizes talented people, draws them in, and utilizes them at their fullest? Would they say they've grown more around you than any other manager they have worked for? Or would they describe you as someone who pulled them into your organization, not as a talent to be developed, but more as a resource to be deployed and then left to languish? Would they perhaps say that they were heavily recruited, but not given a meaningful role, just a visible role, and were serving as a showpiece or hood ornament in your organization? Some leaders are like magnets that draw in talent and develop it to its fullest. Other leaders acquire resources to build their empire. This chapter explores the differences between these two approaches to management of talent and the impact that both types of leaders have on the people around them. The empire builder versus the talent magnet. Multipliers operate as talent magnets to attract talented people and then use them to their fullest capacity, that is, working at their highest point of contribution. Multipliers have access to the best talent, not because they are necessarily great recruiters, but because people flock to work for them. As Meg Whitman found Mitt Romney, people seek out a talent magnet, knowing that their capabilities will be appreciated and also that their value will appreciate in the marketplace. In contrast, diminishers operate as empire builders who hoard resources and underutilize talent. They bring in top talent and make big promises, but then they underutilize their people and disenchant them. Why? Because they are often amassing the resources for self-promotion and their own gain. Empire builders accumulate rather than multiply. They collect people like knickknacks in a curio cabinet, on display for everyone to see, but not well utilized. Each of these approaches produces a self-perpetuating cycle. The talent magnet spawns a virtuous cycle of attraction, and the empire builder spawns a vicious cycle of decline. A cycle of attraction. In 1914, when venerated British explorer Ernest Shackleton decided to embark on an expedition to traverse Antarctica, he placed a recruitment advertisement in the Times, London, which read, "Men wanted for hazardous journey, small wages, bitter cold, long months of complete darkness, constant danger, safe return doubtful, honor and recognition in case of success." Surprisingly, hundreds of men applied. Shackleton, with the wisdom of an experienced captain, staffed his crew with men of a certain orientation, men who were attracted to adventure and recognition, but were also realistically prepared for the hardship they would face. No doubt Shackleton's ability to attract the right team was one key factor in the survival of every member of the expedition. The cycle of attraction begins with a leader possessing the confidence and magnetism to surround him or herself with top talent, or A players, sheer raw talent with the right mix of intelligence needed for the challenge. Under the leadership of the talent magnet, the genius of these players gets discovered and utilized to the fullest. Having been stretched, these players become smarter and more capable. A players become A plus players, who are positioned in the spotlight and get kudos and recognition for their work. They attract attention and their value increases in the talent marketplace, internally or externally. A plus players get offered even bigger opportunities and they seize them with the full support of the talent magnet. And then the cycle kicks into hyperdrive. As this pattern of utilization, growth, and opportunity continues to occur, others in the organization and outside notice, and the leader in the organization get a reputation as a place to grow. This reputation spreads, and more A players flock to work in the talent magnet's organization. So there's a steady flow of talent in the door, replacing talent growing outward. This cycle of attraction is exactly what happened to Mitt Romney at Bain & Company and why Meg Whitman knew to join his organization. Talent magnets create a powerful force that attracts talent and then accelerates the growth of intelligence and capability in others, as well as themselves. These leaders operate like an electromagnetic force that, through interactions between atoms, propels matter in the universe. A cycle of decline. For many years, I had the pleasure of working closely with Brian Beckham, a brilliant and affable Canadian. Brian had a reputation for being smart, optimistic, and collaborative, and could solve just about any complex problem that got tossed his way. This reputation earned him a key role as the vice president of operations in a rapidly growing division. The problem was that this division was run by an uncontrolled diminisher and determined empire builder. Brian went to work solving the complex problems of the emerging division, but soon found that the senior vice president running the division didn't really want the underlying issues addressed. The SVP wanted only to grow an empire, and he wanted growth at any cost. Brian's role quickly degenerated into window dressing, where he and his team were only tweaking issues on the surface, just enough so the executive committee would continue to fund additional headcount into the organization. For many months, while Brian continued to pursue his work at full throttle, deep problems were festering at the core of the division. With continued indifference from his manager, Brian became numb and started to settle into mediocrity. He lost good players on his team. When other leaders in the company saw the depth of the problems in the division, Brian's Midas touch reputation was tarnished. After several years of hanging in there, hoping for things to improve, he found himself stuck in a dying organization, watching his opportunities fade. Soon, Brian became one of the walking dead who roamed the halls of so many organizations. On the outside, these zombies go through the motions, but on the inside, they have given up. This is called quit and stay. It was painful to watch this happen to Brian, whom I knew to be an absolute superstar. No doubt you've seen this happen to colleagues in other organizations, or have even been there yourself. Is it possible that it's happening inside your own organization? Empire builders create a vicious cycle of decline. Talent recruited into their organization soon becomes disengaged and goes stale. The cycle of decline begins much like the cycle of attraction, which is why it is easy to be deceived by diminishers. Empire builders seek to surround themselves with A players, but unlike talent magnets, they accumulate talent to appear smarter and more powerful. The leader glosses over the real genius of the people while placing them into boxes on the org chart. The A players have limited impact and start to look more like A minus or B plus. They fail to get noticed for their work, and they lose intellectual confidence. They begin to recede into the shadow of the empire builder. Their value in the job market drops, and opportunities begin to evaporate. So they stay and wait, hoping things will turn around. This cycle of degeneration impacts not only one person, it infects an entire organization. The organization becomes an elephant graveyard, earning a reputation as the place people go to die. As one technology superstar said of his empty vice president job, "I'm definitely past my sell-by date here." The resignation in his voice made it clear. If he were milk, he'd be curdled. Empire builders, having earned their reputation as career killers, continually struggle to get truly top talent into their organizations. Perhaps this is why they labor hard to hoard the resources that they have. Empire builders may initially be able to attract top talent, but their focus on building themselves and their organizations underutilizes the true talent that they have in their organization and renders it stagnant and inert. They generate a cycle of decline that spirals downward. Empire builders hoard resources and underutilize talent. Talent magnets attract talented people and use them at their highest point of contribution. Let's explore the world of the talent magnet. These multipliers who create a cycle of attraction and grow intelligence around them. The talent magnet. The talent magnet creates a cycle of attraction that accelerates performance and grows genius. But does this only work for top talent and for the A players in the market? Or can a true talent magnet find and grow genius everywhere and with everyone? Hexel AG, a maker of generic drugs, is located in a small village close to Munich, Germany. Hexel was founded in 1986 by Thomas and Andreas Strungmann, twin brothers and self-made entrepreneurs. Andreas, a doctor, is the medical authority, and Thomas is the international marketing genius behind Hexel. These brothers teamed their expertise to build a successful generic drug company, growing primarily from the local talent pool in the village. What makes the company unique is that its approach to talent is anything but generic, and it is an approach that gets extraordinary results from very ordinary people. It starts with how these leaders hire people into their company. They explained, "When we consider each person, we ask one or two questions. If they don't fit, we simply don't continue the conversation. If the person is individualistic, we know that he or she won't fit in our culture. When we find someone who will fit with our company, then we spend a lot of time with the person to make sure we understand their capability and what they would bring to our organization." The Strungmann brothers knew how to spot and attract the right talent. Once people joined Hexel, they discovered another one of the Strumans' unconventional practices. Hexel doesn't have jobs, per se, and they don't have an org chart. This isn't like some elite organizations that choose not to publish their org chart for fear that some other company will snatch up their talent. Hexel didn't have an org chart because the Strumans didn't believe in them. Jobs were loosely created around people's interests and unique capabilities. They called their approach the amoeba model. Here's how it works. Ursula's responsibility was to assist the customer service manager. In her role, she saw a large number of repetitive requests for the same action and was continually updating people on the status of these requests. She had an idea to use the internet to create a workflow tracking system. She wrote up a little proposal and sent the idea around to her colleagues in an email asking, "What do you think about it?" Some people replied on email, and others stopped by her desk to discuss it in person. But everyone agreed that it was a good idea and wanted to see it happen. She gathered the people she needed, secured some budget, and got the system built through this makeshift team. The team then presented the system to the Strumman brothers, who applauded their efforts and Ursula's leadership and initiative. These twin brothers simply believed that if an idea got support from a lot of people, it was a good idea. At Hexel, you could work wherever there was energy. Through encouraging their employees to use this heat-seeking approach, they were able to utilize people at their highest point of contribution. They didn't box people into jobs and limit their contribution. They let people work where they had ideas and energy and where they could best contribute. They let talent flow, like an amoeba, to the right opportunities. There are clearly multiple reasons for their success, but it is interesting to note that the Strumman brothers sold Hexel, along with holdings in another company, to Novartis in 2005 for $7.6 billion. At age 55, they were each worth $3.8 billion. As they led Hexel, the Strumman brothers got extraordinary results from very ordinary people. Why? Because these twin talent magnets knew how to unleash people's genius into their organization. How does a talent magnet find and unleash genius? In the four practices of the talent magnet, we find some of the answers. The four practices of the talent magnet. Among the multipliers we studied in our research, we found four active practices that together catalyze and sustain this cycle of attraction. These talent magnets: 1, look for talent everywhere. 2, find people's native genius. 3, utilize people at their fullest. And 4, remove the blockers. Let's look at each to understand exactly what a talent magnet does to create genius in others. Practice number 1, look for talent everywhere. Talent magnets are always looking for new talent, and they look far beyond their own backyard. Multipliers cast a wide net and find talent in many settings and diverse forms, knowing that intelligence has many facets. Appreciate all types of genius. In 1904, a test of intelligence that later evolved into the IQ test was developed by French researcher Alfred Binet as a tool for assessing the learning progress of French school children. His assumption was that lower intelligence signaled not an inability to learn, but a need for more and different teaching. This tool quickly became ubiquitous as a unilateral determinant of intellectual horsepower. Much work has been done over the last two decades by cognitive psychologists around the world offering additional methods for identifying and developing intelligence. Whether it is Harvard professor Howard Gardner's theory of multiple intelligences, Daniel Goleman's work on emotional intelligence, or Stanford professor Carol Dweck's work on the effect of mindsets on capability, the message is clear. IQ is a practical but limited measure of the true intelligence of our species. We are simply smarter in more ways than can be measured through an IQ test. A talent magnet knows that genius comes in many forms. Some minds excel at quantitative analysis or verbal reasoning, capabilities measured through IQ, SAT, and other tests of traditional cognitive intelligence. Other minds offer creative genius, innovating through fresh